It is very rare for an education policy book to become a bestseller, much less a national phenomenon. Diane Ravitch's The Death and Life of the Great American School System has been both, in spades. A chronicle of Ravitch's radical change of heart and an impassioned argument against today's dominant forms of school reform, it has become a Bible of sorts for the anti-reform movement. Today we talk with Diane about her book, the impact it's had on the education policy debate, the reactions it sparked, and her vision for the future. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Diane, welcome to the show.
It's wonderful to see you, Mike.
Well, we're here at the Marriott Woodman Park Hotel in Washington, D.C. You're here to give a talk.
Right.
And so listeners, I hear the hum behind us. That's some other folks in the lobby here. I'm really excited to have you on the show, Diane. And obviously, this is a book that's been hugely important in the policy debates. So much to talk about. Let's start with this. You start the book talking about your own change in thinking around education reform. And it strikes me as it was almost like the old adage that said a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. What happened to you in this conversion experience you had from, say, 2005, 2006, 2007?
Right. Well, you know, it's wonderful to have this conversation with you, Mike, because I think you were there as I was changing my views about so many things. And I was a member, obviously, of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, a founding member, and then as it became the Institute, and at the same time a founding member of the Corrett Task Force at Hoover. I had previously been a member of the Manhattan Institute, not the staff, but one of their scholars, and went with them to testify on behalf of charter legislation in 1998. So I was certainly deeply embedded in conservative think tanks. But I guess that over time, the things that I believed in, I still believe in. I mean, I strongly believe in the importance of a rich curriculum for all children. I would love to see wonderful, great public schools. And I think that I saw the strategies of testing, choice, and accountability as means and not as ends. My ends are unchanged. The means, however, I think, at the time I supported them strongly, it sounded like good ideas. I liked No Child Left Behind. In theory, it sounded great. More than 90% of the Congress endorsed it. Ted Kennedy, more Democrats than Republicans. I don't think it's worked out in practice. I think it's turned out to be the most disastrous federal education ever passed, federal education law ever passed. In terms of the choice policies, I know during the debates, whether at Fordham, but more particularly at the Corrett Task Force, as we talked about charters, in our discussions, we recognized that the results were not very stellar. And in my participation at Fordham, Fordham was, I think, incredibly honest in saying things are not working out as we thought. We have a lot of charter schools that we're authorizing that are in academic emergency or academic watch, and one guy's a thief and another one's doing this and that and the other. So I think Fordham's honesty, in some sense, was part of what made me become much more critical of charters. And then just the changes in the charter movement itself. I mean, I don't want to consume this whole discussion with, I could go on for the full 20 minutes or 30 minutes just saying all the things that came together for me, but it really was the accumulating evidence that made me begin to think this is not working. I mean, I had thought that testing would be used diagnostically, and increasingly it was used punitively, which I thought was bad, or, you know, to give rewards and punishments. That was not what I had thought was the point.
And you say, in effect, that you came to believe that you're a conservative, not a radical. And what school reform was trying to do was radical.
Yeah, and I had this discussion many a time with Checker Finn, where Checker would say we should just blow the whole system up. And I kind of laughingly would say to Checker, I'm not a radical. I could have this vision of Checker with a red bandana around his head going around blowing up public schools. And it just felt like too radical an agenda for me. I mean, I'm a graduate of the Houston Public Schools. I don't think I would be here today if it weren't for the free public education that was available to me and to my mother. my father dropped out of high school. He never made it that far. But I wanted to make public schools better. I didn't want to replace them with privately managed schools. Mm-hmm. And as the, again, more and more evidence coming in about for-profit enterprises where the schools were really lousy or bad schools that were charter schools or voucher schools, and you know, those things had an impact on me. Yeah. I guess that my the hope I had had was not substantiated. And I have to say one thing that I that became a defining moment for me. Well, two really. One of them was the conference that I described, where you were present. Checker was present, sponsored by Rick and Hess and Checker at AEI, where I was asked to sum up the day's proceedings about how's NCLB doing at midpoint. And every single person gave a paper saying, it's not working here, and it's not working here, and it's not working there. And at the end of the day, I concluded it was not working. So that kind of reoriented my vision. That was in late 2006. But then the next year, I was attacked in the New York Post by the head of the business community in New York City as being a hypocrite because I was criticizing things that I had once advocated. And that article made me think, you know, it's true. I am criticizing things I once advocated. And I think I should set the record straight about what do I really believe and why have I changed my views. And so those were, I think, crucial turning points for me.
You know, in that opening chapter, you talk about how reformers are, in many ways, utopian. You know, and that unrealistic about what can be achieved. I mean, does that mean that therefore we have to accept that our public school system is doing the best it can, that this is as much as we can expect?
No, I don't believe in, I mean, for one thing, I hate the status quo. So when people say I'm defending the status quo, it's ridiculous because to me, the status quo is No Child Left Behind. And I was very critical of the schools before No Child Left Behind. I have a much, I would say, richer and more powerful vision of what I would like to see happen. I think that where reformers are utterly utopian is, for example, with No Child Left Behind, saying that 100% of children will be proficient by the year 2014, as though there's some magic in 2014. There's no nation in the world where 100% of the children are proficient. So you either lower the standard of what proficiency means and just say, can you sign your name with more than an X? Or if you're going to have genuine standards, it'll never be 100% because it's never 100%. And I think it is not, I think there is a strain always been in conservatism, an understanding that of the tragic condition of the human condition, the human condition has a certain tragedy built into it. Bad things happen to good people. And the most utopian of aspect of the current reform movement, which I call the corporate reform movement because its ideas are so closely tied to business ideas, but the most utopian and absurd idea is that poverty somehow can be overcome solely by schools.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful paper that I would recommend to you written by Helen Ladd at Duke University. It's called Education and Poverty, Confronting the Evidence. And she basically reviews all the evidence about how powerfully poverty impacts academic achievement. And then she says, we now have a federal policy that says, let's just count on the schools to do it. We don't have to change anything else. Only the schools can do it. She said that has never happened and it's never going to happen. And what's happening now, she says, is we have a federal policy that represents denial. We're trying to pretend that being homeless doesn't matter, being hungry doesn't matter, not having being in ill health and all the terrible impact of poverty, that you can just set a goal and say everybody's going to meet it because I said so,
right.
Except it's not happening and it's not going to happen.
Right. No excuses, so to speak.
Well, no excuses only works with very, very tiny subsets of children.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have challenged Mike Feinberg and Kip generally and said, take over an entire school district. And they don't want to. You have to take over the whole school district. You can't leave any child behind and achieve the results that you achieve taking in a select few.
Yeah.
And until they do that, I will continue to be skeptical.
So one of your chapters is titled Hijacked, and you talk about the way that the standards movement turned into the testing movement. How did that happen?
I think it happened, I go back to the days of the early 1990s when I worked in the first Bush administration, and at that time a lot of people thought it would be great to have voluntary national standards. And the idea at that time was not how high can you jump, but rather setting some kind of curriculum standards. And I was working in the U.S. Department of Education then, So we were working on the idea of national art standards, not with the idea that if we were not saying that if you can't do this, you fail, but rather this is what first graders ought to be doing in the arts. This is what second and third, and these are the resources that are necessary. These are the programs that should be available. So we had a commission through a number of federal agencies, the creation of voluntary national standards in every subject area, is even physical education at the insistence of Arnold Schwarzenegger, who came to see President George H.W. Bush on behalf of physical education. So we had like eight different sets of voluntary national standards, but then in 1994, after we had gone away and left office, the history standards turned into a great national explosion. And people, I think, at that point concluded that the whole idea of standards was simply a toxic idea. And then when George W. Bush came to the presidency, he really didn't talk about curriculum. He only talked about testing. And the whole idea of No Child Left Behind is it has nothing to do with curriculum. It's only about testing. We were into curriculum and into kind of raising people's vision of what a good education is. And his idea was test every child every year and miraculous things happen. But we can now look back over 10 years and say those miraculous things have not happened.
Though there's evidence that the consequential accountability, that test-based accountability, starting in the 90s with some states and then with other states in the early days of No Child Left Behind, that we did get at least a significant one-time bump, particularly in math. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at, right?
Right. I think there have been some gains in math. That's undeniable, but I don't think we're a better educated population 10 years later. And what we have not seen any decline in the remediation rate in colleges. And I think right now the poster child for this kind of NCLB-style reform would be New York City, where we see the graduation rate now up to 65%. But of the graduates who go on to our local colleges, 80% have to be remediated in exactly the things that they've been passing the test in. They're being remediated in reading, writing, and math, and only about less than a quarter of those graduates are considered by the state to be college ready. So I've become very critical of test-based accountability because what I've come to realize, and again, it's part of, I hope I'm still evolving. I mean, I think one of the things I would like to strongly advocate is that we all try to keep an open mind to evidence, and that's just what I've tried to do. But I think I've concluded that test-based accountability is carrots and sticks, and I hate carrots and sticks. I think the carrots and sticks are, you're basically saying that teachers are so lazy that they will not be incentivized unless you offer them a bonus. That, and we know that merit pay has yet to prove itself, and we have a lot of evidence it doesn't work. But there's also this punishment aspect, which I hate, which is if your scores don't go up, we close your school, we fire the staff. Terrible things will happen to you if you don't get higher test scores. And I just think this is wrong, because I think it's actually early 20th century thinking. This is the thinking inspired by Frederick Winslow Taylor and the efficiency experts of his era, who did time and motion studies and said that there is, if you just can get the sanctions and the punishments and the incentives right, you will get more productivity from the workers. You know, that was good for the industrial age. We were able to produce more and better things in the factories, but we're not in the industrial age anymore. We're now in a knowledge economy, and I am persuaded that we have to go to the kinds of people like Edward Deci, DECI, who wrote a book called Why We Do What We Do, to Dan Ariely, who's a behavioral economist. I think he's at Duke or MIT. He wrote a book called Predictably Irrational. And then Daniel Pink has summed up the work of Deci, Ariely, and similar guys. This is 21st century thinking. What they talk about is that the most important motivation is not fear of punishment or the hope of reward, but intrinsic motivation. Mm-hmm. That whether you're talking about students or you're talking about adults, particularly with adults, what motivates them most is a sense of purpose, a sense of professionalism, a sense of autonomy, mastery of their own fate, the ability to make decisions on the spot, not to be subject to a command and control structure tells them you will be punished if you don't do this my way.
So let's talk about that in the New York City context, which is of course something near and dear to your heart, and you write about in the book. I heard Chris Cerf speak the other day. He was one of the deputies under Joel Klein and is now leading New Jersey's education system. And he said that, you know, the strategy all along was at first to centralize some key pieces of the system and get some greater coherence, and then to decentralize it back out to the school level. And that at this point, you've got schools that are much more autonomous than they used to be. That sounds like it would be in line with what you're saying, that we want to give educators more autonomy.
But there's no professional autonomy. Oh, the only thing that's happening in New York City now is that they have basically eliminated all middle management, so that when many of the principals turn out to be not very competent. There's hardly a week goes by without a scandal about some principal who is giving credits out like pieces of, you know, candy. And the staff complaining and so forth and so on. There's no oversight, there's no supervision. Schools are judged solely by one metric. 85% of their grade is based on their test scores. So if your test scores go up, you're a good school. If your test scores don't go up, you're a bad school. It's actually very constraining, because there's no reward for having a great arts program. There's no reward for the excitement and enthusiasm of the students. It's only the test scores on these absolutely lousy standardized tests. And the problem with putting so much weight on the test scores, I mean, there are many problems. One is the narrowing of the curriculum. Another is cheating. And I've been told by many teachers that cheating is rampant, but it's undetected, because whenever there are complaints about cheating, you're told to send it to the chancellor, and it goes into a dark hole somewhere, and that doesn't get investigated. I think a report just came out recently that took 5 years to investigate. The investigator actually retired, and they brought him back to write the report 5 years later. So there's no interest in pursuing allegations of cheating. But by putting all this emphasis on the test scores, you're assuming that the test scores are a terrific measure.
Right.
And just last year, the test scores totally collapsed. We found out that they were not reliable. They were not valid. The state was playing with the passing mark, the cut scores. It was making the tests so predictable that they had become meaningless. So the same people are still doing this at the state level. Why are the scores any more valid and trustworthy now?
Well, I guess one of the testing directors left, right?
He did. He just left in a huff. I mean, this was a very, incomprehensible thing, because this is the guy who had been running the testing part of the department for a very long time. He was not held accountable when the whole mess occurred in 2010, and he sent out a directive to schools across the state saying that they were going to increase the test time for grades 3 through 8 on the English Language Arts exam to 4 hours. Mm. And a lot of people reacted by saying, a 4-hour exam for third graders? I mean, 8, 9, 10-year-old kids, this is a bit much, isn't it? Well, there was apparently it caused some embarrassment, and he was pushed out, forced out. But from what I've read, a directive doesn't go out without being reviewed with lots and lots of people. He didn't make it up all by himself. It's part of we're now into a total command and control, bureaucratic mandates telling everybody what to do. And the people at the school end don't have any autonomy. That's, this is different from professional autonomy.
So let's turn the topic to something else that I know has been something you've cared a lot about, which is Catholic schools. For a long time, we've had evidence that urban Catholic schools have done a great job with poor and minority kids, and yet for 30 years, we've seen these Catholic schools dying and closing. Once the nuns left, once we've had to pay lay teachers competitive wage, once the church subsidies dried up, there's just not enough money to keep these things alive. So one obvious solution is vouchers as a way to support Catholic schools. I sense in the book that you still wrestle with that somewhat. What's your take on Catholic schools at this point?
That's a very good question, because just last week I had breakfast with the leaders of the Cristo Rey Network, and Rob Birdsell, who's the national president of it, put together a meeting for me with the local leader of Cristo Rey, and we talked about this, and I've thought about it a lot.
And Cristo Rey is a network of
Catholic
Jesuit schools.
Yes, Jesuit schools, and they do a great job.
Yeah.
And I've thought about this a lot, and the way I reconcile it is that we could save Catholic schools. First of all, there are several reasons why Catholic schools are in jeopardy today and why they're closing all over the place. And one is because kids have to pay tuition in Catholic school, and they're being, in many places, driven out of business by the charter movement. And I discussed this with Checker when I was at Hoover, and I said, look, we both admire Catholic schools, and the big fish is eating the little fish being the Catholic schools, and he just shrugged and said, you know, that's tough, that's life. Well, I think it's wrong, and so the principle that I come up with, right or wrong, is that public money should go to public schools. Private money should go to non-public schools. There are now literally hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more, being poured, of private money being poured into charters. If some portion of that were to go into Catholic schools would survive. One of the things about Cristo Rey that's very attractive is that every parent's expected to pay something. There's no free lunches, part of their attitude. So their minimum is $500, and every parent can come up with $500. And then the kids work one day a week, and the place that the kids work in pays $30,000 to the school for kids who are, in essence, interns 4 or 5 days a week in the firm. So it's a way that the corporations are subsidizing the Cristo Rey schools. But again, I think that if the Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, the Walton Foundation, this would be crumbs off their table to save Catholic education. But instead, they're pouring all this money into charter schools, which in many cases are no better than the regular public schools.
Well, in some cases, they're pouring money into political advocacy to try to get more voucher programs with the idea that even they don't have enough money to sustain.
Gates has enough money. But I strongly disapprove of all of these foundations. I mean, the thing that really disturbs me about the foundations is not that they do what they do, because they're free to spend their money as they wish, but there are no foundations on the other side. There's literally no money to oppose all of these huge foundations, whether it's, it's even now Ford, Gates, Carnegie, Walton, Broad, Dell. I mean, you can just go down the line with the Fisher Foundation. Hundreds of millions of dollars, perhaps billions of dollars, all in support of one agenda. What if that agenda is wrong?
Yeah.
What about, how's it possible to change your mind when there's no money to support people with a different point of view?
Now, you know, and you probably have the most memorable phrase in your book is the billionaires' boys club, as you call this. But isn't it true that, the reason these foundations support reform is that they have been convinced by reformers that these are good ideas? And generation ago, you had the Ford Foundation, and you had more traditional Rockefellers who were supporting other things. And so you make your case, and you're going to convince some of them to change their ways.
I think that the problem with the agenda that they have is that the evidence is against it. And we could obviously argue about that because you don't agree with me. And I think that it would be nice if there were a few foundations who looked at the evidence and said, I don't agree with the Billionaire Boys Club. I would like to support a different narrative. Yeah. There are none that do that.
Even George Soros,
no.
Ford, Rockefeller, no. The traditional liberal.
None of the traditional liberal organizations. Everybody is on one side. And I think in a democracy, it would be nice to have some diversity of opinion. And I think one of the reasons that my book has proven to be such a rallying cry is that there's no money for the, you can talk about the power and money of the unions, but there's no money to support organizations that disagree with the Billionaire Boys Club agenda. So they have all the money. They have a bipartisan, there used to be, this is to me the most curious fact of our times. When I worked in Washington in the early 1990s, the Democrats were strongly in favor of equity above all, and the Republicans were in favor of testing, choice, and accountability. So now we have both parties supporting testing, choice, and accountability, and the equity agenda seems to have slipped off the table.
Right. Now, you mentioned teacher unions. Some people would argue, I would argue, that the teacher unions are that counterbalance. That in many ways, actually, these foundations, what's new is that they, for the first time, are a large and powerful enough group to challenge what used to be the teacher union hegemony, that these teacher unions had so much power, so much influence, so much political money. And for the first time in decades, they're now being challenged. What's wrong with that narrative?
I think that given the fact that there are lots of people who support public education, I think it's wrong that there is no foundation willing to support parents and citizens who don't like what is happening in terms of privatization. And you can call that the union's agenda, but I think in this case the unions are right. There's also a strong agenda to what I see is what you call the reformers and I call the corporate reformers. Their fundamental objective, in my view, and I may be wrong about this, but their fundamental objective is, first of all, to privatize as much as possible, to open the revenues of public education up for entrepreneurs who can make money. Some of them have that goal, some of them don't. And second objective is deprofessionalization, literally to lower the standards for entry into teaching. I would like to see much higher standards for entry into teaching. And yet we now see, for example, Teach for America, which is a very nice organization. And, you know, I always say that if I were getting out of college, I'd probably join it. I think it's a lovely idea. But the idea that it can be a replacement for a really serious change and reform of the teaching profession is ludicrous. I was in Finland in September, and when I told people there that we have this organization that sends young people in with 5 weeks of training, their eyes pop. They couldn't believe that we would allow anyone in the classroom with 5 weeks of training.
But they would probably be just as surprised that most of our education schools are open enrollment. And as you have a high school diploma, you can go in and get trained as a teacher.
Well, we have online programs now that are giving teaching degrees and that are giving master's degrees based on never having interacted with a student. I think it's wrong.
Yeah.
I want to see much higher standards. I would like to see the kind of standards they have in Finland, where they have an incredibly successful system, no standardized testing, and a standard of excellence in teaching where only one out of 10 people who apply to be a teacher can even get into the program.
Yeah. All right, so in the end of the chapter and end of the book, you talk about your vision for where to go from here, and you return to a theme that many of your readers will find familiar, which is curriculum. I'm curious if you think that the Common Core State Standards Initiative that's now being implemented in most parts of the country, is that getting us closer to that vision you have for a strong curriculum?
Well, my view of the Common Core State Standards is completely agnostic. I'm neither for them nor against them. And I've told everybody involved with them who I've been courted, you know, by whether it's David Coleman or by Dane Lynn or this one or that one, and then they would like me to support them because I've been an outspoken proponent of national curriculum standards. And I've said to them, as I also said to people in the White House when asked, that standards aren't real just because they're words on paper. Mm-hmm. Standards only become real when they're implemented. When they're implemented, you find out that some things that you put in there are ridiculous, some things work really well, some things are too hard for that grade and belong somewhere else, or too easy for that grade and belong somewhere else. But that's called field testing. There has been no field testing. And I suggested to the White House that they ought to get two or three states to field test them and make them better, and then put them out for widespread adoption. But they were so eager to say that they did this that they've simply put them out there for 45 states, no field testing. And if the FDA did that with a drug, they'd probably be hauled into court. So I'm concerned about the lack of trial and error of implementation. And when these Common Core standards are implemented, we'll learn things. And we'll learn if they're good or if they're bad. We'll learn if they actually increase the achievement gap, which they might. Mm-hmm. We'll learn if they raise achievement, which they might. But I don't know. And until we see some evidence, I can't make a judgment.
Last question. Are you optimistic about the future?
Yeah, actually, I am optimistic. And I'll tell you why. Although, I can tell you now, because over the last year, a year and a half, I've spoken to well over 100,000 teachers, and they're very demoralized. So it's easy to feel pessimistic, because a lot of people come to me and they say, I've been teaching for 15 years, I've gotten honor after honor, I can't stand the negative climate created by this reform movement, I'm quitting. And I wonder, how in the world do you think you're going to attract good teachers or great teachers if you continue bashing teachers as this reform movement has, if you continue with this nonsensical judging of teachers by student test scores, which is has no scientific background to it. But I'm optimistic because I feel that the corporate reform movement is failing, that it's what it's doing is harmful, that it has no evidence or research to support things like merit pay or judging teachers by test scores or the rapid expansion of charter schools, because we now have a tremendous body of evidence that says there'll be some great ones, there'll be some bad ones, but on the whole they don't produce different results. So given the fact that there's no evidence for the agenda, at some point the agenda will implode. And it may take 3 years, 5 years, maybe 10 years. And at that point, we'll begin to put together, I hope, a much better, higher, richer vision of what good public education is and begin to think seriously about raising standards for entry into teaching, so it becomes much harder to become a teacher, and that those people who enter the classroom are better prepared. And then at some point we'll stop saying there's no money to do things right, so let's do them cheap and mean and dirty. So I think that we're a good nation and a great nation and a generous nation, and we'll come to our senses, but right now we're not there.
All right, thank you very much. Diane Ravitch, the author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. Thanks for joining us on the Education Next Book Club.
Thank you, Mike.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.